Chapter 4. The summer sunlight heightened the contrast of colors in the mile-high altitude of Colorado. The sky was free of clouds, a vivid blue that spread over the city of Denver like a quilt. The temperature was a comfortable 81 degrees. Isaac Bell closed the door to his stateroom and left the train by stepping off the observation platform at the rear of the Pullman car. He paused to look up at the clock tower of the Gothic-style Union Station. Built of stone, hauled down from the Rocky Mountains, the imposing three-story structure stretched a quarter of a mile. The arrowhead-tipped hands of the huge clock read 11:40. Bell lifted his large gold watch from the vest pocket of his tailored linen suit and glanced at the hands that pointed to Roman numerals. His time was 11:43. He smiled at himself with satisfaction, knowing for certain that the big clock tower clock was 3 minutes slow. He walked down the red brick platform to the baggage car, identified his trunks, and hailed a porter. "My name is Bell. Could you please see that my trunks are sent to the Brown Palace Hotel?" The porter smiled broadly at the gold coin Bell laid in his hand and rubbed it almost reverently. "Yes, sir, I'll deliver them myself. I'm also expecting a large wooden crate on a later train. Can I count on you to make sure it is delivered to the Union Pacific Freight Warehouse?" "Yes, sir, I'll take care of it." Still rubbing the gold piece, the porter grinned broadly. "I'd be grateful." "May I take that for you?" said the porter, nodding at the valise in Bell's hand. "I'll keep it with me, thank you." "Can I hail you a taxi?" "That won't be necessary. I'll take the tram." Bell strolled through the high-ceilinged grand lobby of the depot, with its majestic hanging chandeliers, past the rows of high-backed oak waiting benches, and out the main entrance, flanked by twin Grecian columns. He crossed Wynkoop Street onto 17th Street and passed under the newly erected Mizpah Arch, a gate-light structure with a pair of American flags flying on top that was built to welcome and bid farewell to train travelers. Mizpah, Bell knew, meant watchtower in ancient Hebrew. Two ladies wearing light summer dresses, gloves, and ornate hats decorated with flowers drove by in an electric battery-powered car. Bell doffed his hat, and with nods and smiles, they acknowledged the attention of the attractive man as they motored up 17th Street toward the state capitol building. Horse-drawn wagons and carriages still outnumbered the few automobiles that chugged up and down the streets of the city. A Denver Tramway Company trolley car clanged around the corner off Wazee Street and approached the end of the block, where it stopped to let off and take on passengers. The horse-drawn railways were a thing of the past, and electric trolleys ruled the streets, reaching every neighborhood in Denver. Bell climbed the steps and gave 10 cents to the motorman. The bell was clanged, and the big red trolley clattered up 17th Street. 3- and 4-story brick buildings filled the next 14 blocks. The sidewalks were crowded with people on a typical business day. The men wore black or gray suits and ties, while the women strolled in the long dresses whose skirts rose just above the ankles. Most of the women wore flamboyant hats and carried parasols. He observed with interest a store that was selling Cadillac motor cars. The awnings were rolled out, shadowing the windows and revealing the vehicles inside. He glanced at the street signs so he could recall the location. An enthusiast of motor cars, he owned a locomobile race car that had been driven by Joe Tracy in the 1905 Vanderbilt Cup road race on Long Island in New York, placing third. Bell had converted it to street driving by adding fenders and headlamps. He also owned a bright red motorcycle. The newest racing model, its V-twin engine, put out 3.5 horsepower. It had an innovative twist-grip throttle, weighed only 120 pounds, and could whip over the roads at nearly 60 miles an hour. When the trolley rattled to a stop at California and 17th Streets, Bell stepped down the stair to the pavement and sauntered over to the sidewalk. It had been 3 years since he had set foot in Denver. Tall buildings stood on almost every corner, and the construction never stopped. He walked a block to the Colorado building, a brown stone structure that rose 8 stories on 16th and California streets. The windows were high and shielded by awnings that matched the brown exterior of the walls. The overhang above the top floor stretched nearly 10 feet over the sidewalk far below. Hedgecock and Jones and the Brayman Clothing Company occupied the street level. Above them were several different businesses, including the Fireman's Fund Insurance Company and the Van Dorn Detective Agency. Bell turned into the lobby and moved through a group of office workers who were streaming out of the building on their lunch break. The floor, walls, and ceiling were beautifully constructed of green Italian marble the color of jade. He entered an Otis elevator behind two pretty young ladies and moved to the rear of the car as the operator closed the steel scissor gate door. As was the custom, Bell played the gentleman and removed his wide-brimmed hat. The elevator operator pivoted the handle on the curved throttle housing, sending the elevator toward the upper floors at a leisurely pace. The women exited at the 5th floor, chatting gaily. They both turned and gave Bell a bashful glance before disappearing down the hallway. The operator stopped the elevator and opened the door. 8th floor and a good afternoon to you, sir, he said cheerily. Same to you, replied Bell. He exited into a hallway painted a muted Mexican red above, with walnut wainscot halfway up the wall below. He turned right and came to a door with etched lettering on the upper glass that advertised the Van Dorn Detective Agency. Beneath was the agency's slogan, "We never give up. Never." The antechamber was painted white with 2 padded wooden chairs and a desk, behind which a young woman sat primly in a swivel chair. Van Dorn was not a man to waste money on ostentatious decor. The only embellishment was a photo of the head man hanging on the wall behind the secretary. She looked up and smiled sweetly, admiring the well-dressed man standing opposite her. She was a pretty woman, with soft brown eyes and wide shoulders. May I help you, sir? Yes, I'd like to see Arthur Curtis and Glenn Irvine. Are they expecting you? Please tell them Isaac Bell is here. She sucked in her breath. Oh, Mr. Bell, I should have known. Mr. Curtis and Mr. Irvine did not expect you until tomorrow. I managed to catch an earlier train out of Independence, Missouri. Bell looked at the sign on her desk. You're Miss Agnes Murphy? She held up her left hand, displaying a wedding band. Mrs. Murphy. Bell smiled his beguiling smile. I hope you don't mind if I simply call you Agnes, since I'll be working here for a time. Not at all. She rose from her desk, and he could see she wore a pleated blue cotton skirt with her white fluffy blouse. Her hair was piled atop her head in the fashion of the Gibson girl, which was so popular then. Her petticoats rustled as she went through the door to the inner offices. Always curious, Bell moved around the desk and looked down at the letter Mrs. Murphy had been typing on a Remington typewriter. It was addressed to Van Dorn and spelled out the superintendent of the Western State's displeasure at having Bell come in and take over the unsolved case. Bell had never met Nicholas Alexander, who headed the Denver office, but he was determined to be courteous and polite to the man despite any antagonism. Bell moved away from Mrs. Murphy's desk and stood looking out the window over the rooftops of the city when Alexander walked into the anteroom. He looked more like the bookkeeper of a funeral parlor than the chief investigator who had unraveled many crimes and brought the offenders to full justice. He was a short man, his head barely coming up even with Bell's shoulders. He wore a coat that was too large and his trousers were baggy. The high collar of his shirt showed wear and sweat stains. His head was devoid of hair except around the temples and at the rear. The eyebrows were trimmed as neatly as his hair. A pair of pince-nez glasses were clipped to the bridge of his nose in front of almost sad-looking gray-green eyes. Alexander held out his hand as his lips spread into a smile that was completely lacking in humor. "Mr. Bell, I'm honored to meet Van Dorn's finest agent." Bell didn't buy the compliment since there was no hint of warmth about it. "The honor is mine in meeting you," Bell replied, nearly biting his tongue. It was obvious Alexander simply thought of Bell as an interloper into his private territory. "Please come on back. Before I show you to your new office, we'll have a talk." Alexander abruptly turned and strode stiffly through the door into the inner offices. Mrs. Murphy stood aside and smiled sweetly as they passed. Alexander's office was positioned in the only corner with a panoramic view of the mountains. The other offices were small and windowless. Bell observed that they were also doorless, offering almost no privacy. Alexander's domain was embellished with cowhide sofas and chairs. His aspen desk was expansive and completely barren of paperwork. Though Alexander's suit was a poor fit and bore wrinkles, he was fastidious about his working habits. He seated himself in a high-backed chair behind his desk and motioned Bell to sit in an uncushioned wooden chair on the opposite side. The only thing missing for intimidation, Bell thought, was a platform under Alexander's workspace so he could look down on his employees and visitors like a minor god on Mount Olympus. "No, thank you," Bell said quietly. "After sitting on a train for 2 days, I'd prefer a softer seat." He lowered his long frame onto one of the sofas. "As you wish," said Alexander, not pleased with Bell's superior demeanor. "You were not here when I worked on a case 3 years ago." "No. I came 6 months later when I was promoted from our Seattle office." "Mr. Van Dorn spoke very highly of you," Bell lied. Van Dorn had not mentioned him. Alexander folded his hands and leaned across the empty wasteland of his desk. "I trust he briefed you on the murderer and his operations?" "Not in conversation." Bell paused to hold up the valise. "But he gave me several reports that I examined while riding on the train. I can see why the felon responsible for the robberies and murders is so difficult to pin down. He plans his criminal ventures with extreme care, and his techniques appear to be flawless. All reasons why he eludes capture. After absorbing the material, I do believe his fetish for detail will be his undoing," said Bell thoughtfully. Alexander looked at him suspiciously. "What, may I ask, brought you to that conclusion?" "His jobs are too perfect, too well-timed. One small miscalculation could prove his last." "I hope we can have a close relationship," Alexander said with veiled animosity. "I agree," said Bell. "Mr. Van Dorn said I could have Art Curtis and Glenn Irvine on my team, if it is all right with you." "Not a problem. I wouldn't go against Mr. Van Dorn's wishes. Besides, they told me they worked with you a few years ago." "Yes, I found them to be dedicated agents." Bell came to his feet. "May I see my office?"
"Of course."
Alexander came from behind his desk and stepped into the hallway. Bell saw that all the offices were quite small and quite plain. The furniture was sparse and there were no pictures on the walls. Only one other agent was present in the office, a stranger to Bell whom Alexander did not bother to introduce. Before Alexander could point out a closet office, Bell asked innocently, "Do you have a conference room?" Alexander nodded. "Yes, on the opposite side of the hallway from the offices." He stopped, opened a door, and stood aside as Bell walked in. The conference room stretched nearly 30 feet and flowed 15 feet to the side. A long pine table, stained dark and with a polished surface, sat beneath two massive circular chandeliers. 18 leather captain's chairs were spaced evenly around it. The room was paneled in pine that matched the table, the floor carpeted with deep red pile. High windows rose on one wall, allowing the early afternoon sunlight to illuminate every corner of the room.
"Very nice," said Bell, impressed. "Very nice."
"Yes," said Alexander, with pride showing in his bloodhound eyes. "I use it frequently for meetings with politicians and influential people in the city. It gives the Van Dorn Detective Agency significant respect and an image of importance."
"It will do nicely," Bell said matter-of-factly. "I'll work in here."
Alexander looked directly at Bell, a fiery look in his eyes that suddenly glowed with anger.
"That's not possible. I won't permit it."
"Where is the nearest telegraph office?"
Alexander seemed taken aback. 2 blocks south on 16th Street in Champa. Why?
"I'll send a message to Mr. Van Dorn requesting the use of your conference room as an operations center. Considering the importance of the case, I'm sure he will give it his blessing."
Alexander knew when he was licked.
"I wish you well, Mr. Bell," he conceded. "I will cooperate with you any way I can."
He then turned and left Bell to return to his suite in the corner. He paused in the doorway.
"Oh, by the way, I've reserved a room for you at the Albany Hotel."
Bell smiled.
"That won't be necessary. I've booked a suite at the Brown Palace."
Alexander appeared confused.
"I can't believe Mr. Van Dorn would allow that on your expense account."
"He didn't. I'm paying for it out of my own funds." Not aware of Bell's prosperous situation, the superintendent of the Western States looked completely bewildered. Unable to comprehend, but not wanting to ask questions, he returned to his office in a daze and closed the door, utterly defeated. Bell smiled again and began spreading out the papers he'd carried in the valise on the conference table. Then he stepped into the anteroom and approached Agnes Murphy. "Agnes, could you let me know when Curtis and Irvine show up?"
"I don't expect them back until tomorrow morning. They went up to Boulder on a bank fraud case."
"All right, then. And would you call the building maintenance superintendent and have him come up? I have some alterations to make in the conference room."
She looked at him questioningly. "Did you say the conference room? Mr. Alexander seldom allows the help to step inside. He keeps it mostly to entertain the town bigwigs."
"While I'm here, it will be my office." Agnes looked at Bell with newly found respect.
"Will you be staying at the Albany Hotel? That's where most all visiting agents stay."
"No, the Brown Palace."
"Mr. Alexander consented to the extra expenditure?" she asked warily.
"He had no say in the matter." Agnes Murphy stared after him as if she had just seen the Messiah. Isaac Bell returned to his office and rearranged the chairs to the conference table so he could have a large workspace at one end. After a few minutes, the building superintendent arrived. Bell explained the alterations he wished to make in the room. The end wall was to have a layer of soft material so a map of the western states and towns the killer had hit could be pinned to it. Another layer was to be installed on the inside wall for information, photos, and drawings. The superintendent, after Bell had offered him a $20 gold piece, promised to have the installation accomplished by noon the next day. Bell spent the rest of the afternoon organizing and planning his hunt for the bank killer. At precisely 5 o'clock, Alexander stuck his head in the door on his way home.
"Are you settling in all right?"
he asked icily. Bell did not bother to look up.
"Yes, thank you."
He finally looked into Alexander's angry eyes.
"By the way, I'm making some changes in the room. I hope you don't mind. I promise to put it back exactly the way it was when the case is closed."
"Please see that you do.
Alexander swung his head in a gesture of dismissal and left the office. Bell was not happy that things were not going well between Alexander and him. He had not planned to get in a game of quarrelsome loggerheads with the head of the agency's office, but if he hadn't gone on the attack, he knew that Alexander would have walked all over him.